This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zenden for Jane Lindholm. Well, a good portion of today's program involves some old-school products and ideas with some very new twists. And we're going to start with cardboard, which has actually been around since the early 1800s. But a couple of Vermonters who've been working with cardboard for a while now have come up with a novel use of the old packaging material. They're building cardboard pinball machines. And that's just one interesting aspect of this story that we'll ask them about. You might be familiar with their work. If you have your own questions, feel free to call us at 1-800-639-2211. We're talking about Ben Matchstick and Pete Talbot, the creators of Pinbox 3000 and the founders of Cardboard Tech Institute. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
It's wonderful to be
thank
here.
Thank you.
So you have a great video, which I've watched, which gives a great sense of what this machine looks like and how it works. But since it's radio, and I think some people are going to have a hard time getting their head around this idea of a cardboard pinball machine, Ben, maybe you could describe it for us.
Well, we started from the bottom up and used our abilities at bending cardboard and using a laser cutter to prototype this machine. We never really started with a box. We started with engineering. And there were no 3D programs when we created this, so we just kind of used our hand and eye skill that we've been using over the last 10 years when we work with cardboard. And we put together a, 2 foot by 14 foot, very sturdy.
14 foot?
14 foot, did I say? 14 inch. In my mind, it's 14 feet because I've been staring at it. But it's all rubber band powered and gravity fed. We've imported the gravity from Antarctica where it's finest and pure. And it's got a nice grade to it. All the pinball players, when we take it to the convention, say this plays very well, and you can hit all your shots like a normal pinball machine. You can call your shots. You can customize it. Each game comes with two interchangeable play fields that you can switch out. So it is a system of play. The play fields act like cartridges. So this is the Xbox of cardboard. And it's trying to encourage our communities to get back to tinkering on this little micro level. And we've found that it's easily adapted to all kinds of crafts and small technologies and broken toys and what have you. And that video you mentioned is on Kickstarter right now. So that's our campaign.
And you mentioned that pinball aficionados say, oh, yeah, it works like the real thing. But we're not talking about something like a regular pinball machine that's constantly making noise and lighting up and all that kind of, accompanying sound and visual that goes with a pinball machine.
You have to make your own noises. You have to, so you make your own noises. This is the whole fun of it, is there's no prescripted way to play it. There's no, it's not just tap and swipe. Over here, you have to kind of install your own obstacles. And, we kind of think of it as a pointless machine. So we have these sequential objectives that we like to encourage people to make. Once first you do this, then you do this. And then soon enough, you find yourself going, ba-doo, 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 and just adding your own kind of inspiration and theatricality every time you play. We're puppeteers. We came into this world through puppetry, and this is kind of like self-motivated puppetry. And the puppeteers just get to stand back and, pare their fingernails and watch people gravitationally push this little marble around, and it's super addicting.
So there's a lot of room for the user to use his or her imagination in this. And from what I gathered from the video, the user is the one who has to assemble this, too. It takes about 45 minutes, maybe 39, I think, separate parts, it said. And once it's assembled, then, and you've kind of alluded to this a little bit, you can integrate things that aren't, go beyond the 39 parts, anything practically, into the pinball machine. So maybe explain that a little bit, Pete.
Yeah, you can pretty much integrate all the rest of the parts that in the world. So you could have, organic. You'd have we put stones into a game, and they've made these nice little clink, clink, clink noises as the marbles hit them. You can add microprocessors, and you can actually put your own sounds, program your own sounds into the game if you want to get really technical or simple with it. The simplexity is up to you, so you can really get into it. We found that everyday items that you maybe would view as recycling or something that didn't have a value after they've been used, like a paper towel tube. You can snip it and put it into the game, and then it creates these amazing the marbles fly off of it and create these incredible motions. So it gives new life to everything.
Is this something that, you know, is there an age group it's directed at? Is it not going to work so well for kids under 10 as it would for older people?
Well, I've done workshops with kindergartners where we kind of punch all the parts out together and we talk as we build it. And it's like doing a magic show. You know, you put all this stuff together and just looks like nothing. It looks like nothing and suddenly starts taking three-dimensional form. And then before you know it, you're adding rubber bands and the kids just start to, like, spark up. And you know, we found that just having this, like, tactile machine that they can really – you can really pound this thing. And I think, you know, that is a level of play that, you know, is often not encouraged when we give – kids a toy, they can really whack on this thing and they could go the distance. We've seen it.
Really? Even though it's made of cardboard?
Well, we've engineered it. And when we did our prototypes, I was running an after-school program in Montpelier, and we just threw all our prototypes on the floor. And when the parents showed up, they said, he's being so rough. They're being so rough. And I'm like, no, this is great. We're getting getting great feedback from this. And so we actually added a part called the Crush Protector, which is inspired by our work with the after-school kids. We've been working with cardboard long enough. We pick up a box, you know, on the side of the road, and Pete and I will just stop dead in our tracks and say, "Look at this."
The folds are nice.
Yeah, the folds, the way it's using its rigidity.
The locking system.
Well, Ben, you've been talking a little about it as kind of a learning tool. Just to, you know, expand, if you would, a little bit about what people are learning. Are we just learning how to put something together? What else are people learning as they use these machines?
Well, of course, there's a great initiative happening right now around STEAM or STEM education. We like to put the A back in the science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. So we start with the engineering and putting it together, of course, and then you kind of gradually move into the arts. We did a great workshop here in Burlington with Edmonds Elementary where they built the systems of the human body in pinball. And so it was great because we got to hear these little discussions groups about how to translate biological information into mechanical information. And before we knew it, our neurons were pinging with all this information about all the great discussions you can have around what is essentially what we've created is a problem-solving, problem-generating machine. So you make every time you add something, you maybe solve one problem, uh-huh. But you've created three more.
How many of these machines, or how available are these machines at this point?
So we've initially done a run of 2,000 for our beta test, and we got a lot of feedback from the people that have got those and played with those, and we're sold out of that. Of any available pin boxes right now, but the only way to get them is through our Kickstarter right now that's active. So if you go to pinbox3000.com or Kickstarter, which is a crowdfunding platform,
right.
It helps us to raise money for this next round of production and to buy the dies and the tooling needed. And then you can find our current Kickstarter on that. And
I think you're trying to raise, $95,000?
Yeah.
It's quite a lot of money, but that's what we need to get U.S. production. And once we have that, then, you know, we're really motivated to bring it into schools. And so we want to make a lot of great deals for educators so they can get a whole classroom pack and sync it up with our curriculum ideas.
If you reach that Kickstarter goal, does that basically set you up to mass produce these?
It really does, and we could really, like, you know, throw a switch and then have, you know, almost as many as we need.
And where are you going to do this in central Vermont?
Unfortunately, there's not a lot of companies around here that can do this kind of work, so we are working very closely in Philadelphia. This is a company called Weber in Philly, and they're doing a great job. You know, of course, it's a very outside of the box, if I may say, type of project, and they've just been very amenable. We're also working with a branding firm down there that is generously donating a lot of their time and putting things back into the educational outreach that we have. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some schools that will get, you know, pin boxes at the end through them. It's great.
Are pin boxes just the beginning? Are there other ideas that you're working on?
Yeah. So this is our first kind of product. Usually Ben and I are the product. We're the puppeteers, you know, walking the 13-foot-tall AT-AT puppet, you know, down the make fair. But the next step is we really want to create a place that people can visit. You know, our website is going to have a lot of resources about what you can do with cardboard, trying to, you know, bring cardboard into people's vision as something that you can create with. And it's not just this cast off, you know, my thing came in this and now I'm just going to put this in the recycling bin. It has so many uses and it's an incredible resource. So we want to help people.
Is that where the Cardboard Tech Institute comes in?
Yeah. Well, yes, we're going to get back to our roots. When I started CTI 10 years ago, we had a little free school where we would use cardboard to teach all manners of things. So we'd like to get back into, you know, we're kind of our funny educational encouragement of, you know, peaceful negotiations with, you know, being engaged in play. And you know, that is really what we're after, is everyone just kind of playing with their environments and playing with each other. And, you know, this play is really where we come in. You know, we think as men in our society, we just need more people to just kind of stop what they're doing and just sit down together and agree to some kind of narrative constructed environment that has peaceful negotiations happening all the time, and it's all around play. And so we feel like this is our kind of a mission. It's been our 10-year mission to kind of get people to just engage with each other, to engage with their environment, to see waste in a different way, interrupt the plastic and Disney-fied structure that has been put in place for us.
We're talking to Pete Talbot and Ben Matstick. We have them for a few more minutes. If there's something you've heard that's brought a question to mind about what they're making or the ideas behind what they're doing, then feel free to call us at 1-800-639-2211. You mentioned the maker movement. So for those not familiar, how does this fit in with it?
The maker movement it's kind of like it's so exciting. It's so many things. We've kind of tapped into it with the Pinbox, you know, providing this platform for people to easily start creating. Of course, people have been making, you know, their own pegboard pinball games, you know, when they're young, and I, you know, made cardboard games when I was a little kid too. And but this kind of provides a jumping off point.
There's all this new technology that's emerged with 3D printing and drones and laser cutting and rapid prototyping.
It's interesting that, you know, you're talking about kind of a, you know, a product that's been around and we consider basically unusable once we take out whatever's been in the box. And yet there's a high-tech element to it with 3D printers and, you know, there's technology enables you to do what you're doing.
Right. Well, we encourage people to come out to the Champlain Maker Faire this weekend so they can get their hands on the Pinbox and see for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for mentioning that. So is there a scoring mechanism on these Pinboxes?
Yeah, you just drag you know, your knife against the thing and you fold it and you score it.
What is each of yours high score?
Well, like I said, we talked about this early on, that pinball machines are kind of ridiculous, because when gamers talk about them, they say, well, I got 500 million points, not really a good score. but we like to think of it kind of as we approach our approach is like through the making of it. So we have these sequential objectives that we try to encourage people, like, first you do this, you lock the ball, then you got to free the ball out, then you get multi-ball,
and then
you fill up this little target. And so I think that helps kids and makers of all types kind of think of these different avenues and paths to get a successful game or any project off the ground.
Well, it's been a lot of fun and really interesting talking to you both. Thanks very much.
Thank you
so much.
Ben T. Matstick and Pete Talbot, creators of Pinbox 3000 and founders of the Cardboard Tech Institute. You can find links to the Institute on our Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And if you have any comments about what you've heard Ben and Pete say, then you can add them there as well. Coming up next, we'll look in on Springfield's second annual Steampunk Festival, which starts Friday. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind. Steampunk fairs, festivals, and conventions have been going on around the country for a few years. If you're unfamiliar with steampunk, it combines the style of the Victorian era with the futuristic ideas of writers like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, who, by the way, would be celebrating his 150th birthday today. Well, Springfield is about to host its second annual steampunk festival, and Sabrina Smith, who's the festival's organizer, joins us now. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So my understanding is the festival's rooted in a specific time period, that Victorian Edwardian era. What's the attraction to that period?
Well, the attraction to that period, at least for us who put the Springfield Steampunk Festival on, is the idea of how industrial type of things carry, or, you know, are like considered things of beauty rather than just utilitarian. And so with Springfield being having its industrial history, then for us it was a perfect festival, type of festival to have here.
So what happens during the festival that captures that era?
Well, of course, people are dressed in that era, and of course with steampunk it's a little different than the Victorian era in that women actually wear corsets on the outside of their outfits, that kind of thing, and you'll see lots of goggles and things like that that people are wearing. And and then also at this festival it's set in the Harkness House Inn, mm-hmm. which is a mansion that was built by James Harkness, who was an inventor and also a governor of Vermont. And it's a Victorian era place. So when people come in, last year when people came in, they were like, this is the perfect place to have a steampunk festival because you feel like you're going back in time when you walk into the Harkness House. And then when you see all the people dressed up like that too. So,
From what you're describing, I understand the steam part of it, you know, the recapturing that era. What's the punk part of steampunk?
Punk part of steampunk, really, it comes from going against convention through your creativity and your individuality, you know, whether it's your style or gadgets or attitude or that type of thing. So it's kind of going against the norm. That's where the punk comes from.
And just so people have a clear idea, just give us some of the highlights of the festival. What are some of the events that people might be attracted to?
Well, we have several workshops that are happening. And one of the coolest things I think that people would find is at the Harkness House they have an underground tunnel that goes to a huge observatory. Harkness was into telescopes and that type of thing, so it's a huge telescope that you can look through by going through this underground tunnel. So that's pretty fascinating. And we'll have kind of fun things, like there's the splendid teapot racing, which is just, you know, where people have figured out, you know, put teapots on the top of, like, cars that move around and they race and, you know, have obstacles and things like that. That's just kind of a fun thing. We have the guru of steampunk, Bruce Rosenbaum, will be giving a talk about steampunk design, reimagining resilience. We'll have, of course, the fashion show. There's an absinthe tasting with S.B. McDonald. He's an expert in absinthe and the history and mythology and that type of thing. So it's you get to taste absinthe, but you also get to learn a lot about the history of absinthe. We have a lot of different workshops where people are building different things, you know, which is a big part. Kind of the maker's world is kind of part of the steampunk world, too, where people are always making things, making gadgets, making their own costumes and everything like that. So that there'll be some workshops on that. Let's see.
You had 500 people, rather, at the first annual event last year.
Yeah, we were really pleased. You know, when we started this, the idea of having a festival, we, of course, went into it with no idea if it was going to be successful or not. We started basically with a zero budget, and it was just two of us, and it was an interesting thing to put on. But then as it kind of took a life of its own, and we had people from all over New England who wanted to be vendors there, and then people from all of New England came to the festival. And so we were, you know, pleasantly surprised that we had so many people there.
And so who comes? Is this the Downton Abbey crowd or somebody else?
Well, no, it's not, you know, because it's pre, you know, well, I guess
it's pre-Downton Abbey, but, you know.
So yeah. It is mostly Victorian. There might be some Edwardian in there. It attracts people for different reasons. A lot of people who like to dress up in costumes, like they go to the Renaissance Fair and they do reenactments and things like that, they're really attracted to it from the point of being able to kind of create a character and dress in a, you know, dress up in a different way. And then other people just like kind of the aesthetics of that era. And some people read like the books that you mentioned, Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and mm-hmm. so they're interested in it from that. So people come into it from all different directions.
You know, it sounds like something that appeals, you know, somebody who's not that familiar with steampunk might say, well, that's not for me. You got to really be immersed in this whole idea to go and enjoy that.
Yeah, and it's really not true, because it's so many people came last year who had no idea really about it, but they were really intrigued. And, you know, maybe some dressed up, some didn't, and they just enjoyed kind of learning more about it. And especially people who are from Springfield and they know the history of Springfield, of a history of invention and ingenuity and innovation, then they start seeing the connection of steampunk with Springfield, the town.
But not everybody has a Victorian costume sitting around, so can you go as yourself?
Say that again?
Can you go in, you know, regular street clothes?
Oh, yeah, and there's lots of people who do. And because it does take, a lot of people make their own costumes, so it takes pretty much all year to get ready for a festival like that.
Well, and that brings up the question. We have these festivals. What are there other things the steampunk community is doing the rest of the year?
You mean in Vermont?
Or outside of Vermont, if you happen to live in Vermont and want to go to something.
No, the steampunk community, they might have things like, you know, kind of the mystery dinner type of thing, mm-hmm. you know, in a Victorian house or something like that. And, you know, they get together and they dress up and they have teas and they just do lots of different things that, like, Victorians might have done back in the day.
And so if you had, you know, kind of a blank check to do anything you wanted as part of steampunk, is there one kind of dream project or event that you would do as part of the festival?
Gosh, that's a good question. Well, one of the things, of course, we wanted to do was bring in some of the really, really popular steampunk bands. But we couldn't afford the really big ones, but we were able to get a couple of the, you know, they're still really good bands who travel the festival circuit, the steampunk festival circuit. So I think that's one of the things that we wish that we had a bigger blank.
Well, are they playing music from that era?
Pardon? No, it's really interesting. Steampunk music, it's hard to... lots of times it seems like the people who are the most popular are big bands that do lots of interesting, creative things. So it's kind of that whole creative, you know, aspect of it that attract people to certain bands.
Okay. Well, Sabrina, we're going to have to stop there, but we wish you luck with this festival, the Springfield Steampunk Festival, beginning Friday. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
In a moment, we talk with the new executive director of the ACLU in Vermont.
Hi, I'm Annie Russell, and I'm joined here by Taylor Dobbs. Don't touch that dial. This is not a pledge drive, I promise. We're actually here this week to invite you to participate in the VPR Next Capital campaign. That's a historic effort that will allow VPR to serve the community better than ever before. And I know that sounds like I was reading that off a sheet, but it's really true. We are expanding and we're growing, and we need the facilities to make that possible.
That's right, Annie. And if you call now at 1-800-639-6391, you can be a part of this effort. And one of the great things about the new VPR News Center that's part of this campaign is that it puts everybody who's working on news content together. So that's the digital team, the news staff, and the Vermont Edition staff. And we're all sitting together, and it makes it a lot easier to collaborate and make connections in our content that you wouldn't otherwise see. And it makes for more rich storytelling. And it also helps us bring you the news where you are, whether that's on Facebook or Instagram or on air like you are right now.
And at the end of the day, VPR is about people, right? And so before, what we had was our news staff was in this windowless attic area, and we didn't really have a lot of interaction with the rest of the building or sunlight. And now we're all together in this news center, and I can't really overstate the importance of that, because I know that I'm doing my best work when I'm collaborating with people and we're bouncing ideas off each other. And there are a few projects that you may have seen recently that have benefited from that. Taylor, you just had a big digital project, right?
Right. We did a big story on a system of regulation called alternative regulation. One of the really important parts about that was its online presentation. Online, we have a video that sort of highlights why this stuff is important and a very comprehensive multimedia presentation. And that was made possible by the fact that in the news center, the news staff is sitting right next to the digital production staff, and they are the people who make things look awesome online. So in order for that whole project to come together, I had to be doing the reporting and the writing, but I had to be working very closely with our producer, Emily Alphen Johnson, who helped put together a lot of the graphics and the visuals and make it something that somebody would want to sit down and spend some time really looking through this content and understanding it. Really, in our old building, would have been a lot harder, and making those things easy is a really important part of this campaign so that we can bring you the news in the most efficient and effective way possible.
What we're talking about specifically is the News Center. It really is an incubator for investigative reporting, and it fosters more collaboration, which to us is so important, and we know that it's important for the content that we're bringing you every single day. And so we really hope that you will give us a call. And I would just recommend a gift in the amount of $250, and you get a pretty cool premium with that.
You do. It's a VPR hooded sweatshirt, and you also, your gift will be matched. So if you give $250 today, it's really a gift to us of $500, and it'll go that much further towards helping us develop this new building and really keep bringing you great content every day.
And so this VPR Next campaign is about more than a building, right? It's about the news that we bring you every day, the programming that you're hearing every day. It's about our audience. And that also includes a $2 million innovation fund. So that's going to create the capacity for VPR to tell the whole story of Vermont. And we know that we need to innovate. We need to keep up with where folks are getting their news. You're going to see more groundbreaking journalism. You're going to see more investigative reporting. You're going to hear from more real Vermonters. You'll hear some more podcasts. And it really is news for the age that we're in right now.
You know, one thing that I'm really excited about is this new podcast, Brave Little State. And that's an example of, you know, VPR being able to take a risk. Regular everyday Vermonters will submit their questions that they think need to be answered, and then other people vote on those questions, and the winning question is one that then the Brave Little State team will pick up, and they'll report that out alongside the person who had the question. And that's an example of a different type of journalism that we really haven't tried before, and we're taking a risk on doing that, and that's made possible by gifts like yours to the Program Innovation Fund to help us do more exciting projects like this and keep trying new things into the digital age and really make sure that we're serving you in the best way we possibly can.
So do give us a call now, 1-800-639-6391. Your gift to this campaign is matched by the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. That's a philanthropic organization that supports a lot of causes throughout our region. So again, now is the time to call.
Call 1-800-639-6391. Consider a gift today, again, of $250. We'll send you that great VPR hoodie. Call now, 1-800-639-6391. And you can also give online at vpr.net. And thanks.
And this is Vermont Edition. Earlier this year, James Duff Lyle was named the new executive director of the ACLU in Vermont, succeeding Alan Gilbert. Lyle's a Middlebury graduate who grew up in Massachusetts, but much of his professional career has been out west. We spoke with him this week. James, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Steve.
So you were staff attorney with the ACLU in Arizona, and in Tucson, you set up an office to focus on civil rights issues in the border region. And then before that, you were with an attorney with the Esperanza Immigration Rights Project in Los Angeles. So a lot of background in immigrant rights. What's different in terms, or is anything different in terms of the issues that you're seeing here in Vermont versus the ones you've dealt with in the past?
So a lot of the issues obviously take different shape, different form in different parts of the country. But, you know, I think a lot of the things that I was working on in the Southwest, much of it immigrant rights, police accountability, government surveillance, First Amendment issues. You know, those are all things that are at play here in Vermont and throughout the country. So obviously, they take a different form here in Vermont. But, you know, these are definitely issues that the ACLU of Vermont has been engaged with for some time and right up to the present. We just settled an immigrant rights lawsuit against the DMV, a discrimination case. We have two racial profiling lawsuits currently pending. Racial justice was another big focus of my work in the mm-hmm. Southwest. So, you know, I see my prior work is entirely consistent with the work of the ACLU here in Vermont. And the ACLU is a nationwide organization working on the full range of civil rights and civil liberties issues. And although there are regional variations and different approaches in different places, it's a continual push to move the country forward and move the states forward towards broader protections, civil rights protections for all.
Specifically on immigrant rights, of course, if you're in Tucson, you're near the American-Mexican border. There are mm-hmm. There's a lot of activity there. Mm-hmm. It's a very big issue, and there are probably many different issues regarding dealing with the Border Patrol. Than you're seeing in Vermont. So, you know, bore down for a little for us and explain, to the extent that you've only been in Vermont for a few months, what you're seeing when it comes to immigrant rights issues in Vermont.
Right. So, again, Vermont has obviously taken a very different approach to immigration than Arizona. It's essentially gone in the opposite direction. And the reality on the border is obviously very, very different. Now, that being said, there is a Border Patrol presence in Vermont. There is an international border to the north. There was an article in the Washington Post a couple of months ago about the situation in Derby Line where people described a community that was increasingly militarized, increasingly impacted by a large federal presence, and where neighbors who used to communicate and visit across the international boundary were finding it much harder to do so. And really the description that the Post gave was very reminiscent of descriptions of places like Nogales, Arizona, places in southern Arizona maybe 20 or 30 years ago. So it's certainly different here, but I don't think it would be unfair to say that there is always the risk and the tendency that border militarization, that the national security state expands into new realms when the government improves or expands its operations in one place, they tend to shift to other areas. And it also wasn't all that long ago that the ACLU uncovered design plans for Border Patrol checkpoints on New England southbound highways, which, you know, the government said that there was no intention of ever building anything like that. But the fact is they have those design plans, and it's not inconceivable. Again, we've seen the government tends to expand these kinds of operations rather than rein them in. And so, you know, a lot of the work that I was doing on Border Patrol accountability, police accountability, racial profiling, they were much broader and more intensive in southern Arizona than they are here. But it's not to say those issues aren't at play. And, the latest lawsuit that we settled just a couple of weeks ago with a DMV in which, an immigrant who went in for a driver's license was essentially entrapped and detained by federal immigration authorities, notwithstanding Vermont's very different approach to immigration enforcement, is just another example of the fact that we always need to be vigilant and we always need to be holding government accountable, regardless of what the policies on the books happen to say.
Can you compare and contrast your relationship with law enforcement in Arizona versus Vermont in terms of whether it's more or less adversarial or cooperative?
Well, there's certainly some law enforcement entities in Arizona that recognize what a terrible job the state has done in its approach to immigration policy. I'm talking specifically about SB 1070, the Show Me Your Papers legislation, which has been in effect for the past 6 years. There are many police officials who openly oppose that law on the grounds that the traditional argument that is more widely recognized here in Vermont, that involving local police in federal immigration enforcement is a recipe for abuse and simply undermines the trust of communities and makes all of us less safe. And for that reason alone, it is objectionable. And so there are law enforcement entities in Arizona that have worked to mitigate the damage that that law has done. Fortunately, Vermont has taken a very different approach. But again, even if you get good policies on the books, even if you have driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, even if you have a policy, it's like a trust act or something that restricts the involvement of local law enforcement in immigration, you still have to ensure that those laws are being followed by the government and that people's rights aren't being violated. And we have seen that this does continue to be a problem even here in Vermont.
When you've got a policy like Show Me Your Papers that is such a high-profile policy in terms of people's awareness of it, I wonder if it's easier in a way to engage the public than it is when there's nothing in situations where there's not something that's so stark to put out there and discuss.
Yeah, well, you know, I think Vermont is obviously in a different place than a state like Arizona, but I really think it's a mistake for anybody in this state or anywhere else to just assume that, you know, the problems facing this country are things that happen elsewhere and don't really affect Vermont or states that are see themselves as different or are not like other places. You know, the fact of the matter is Vermont, like much of the country, has massive racial disparities from school discipline to police arrest to incarceration rates. The fact is that Vermont is essentially behind the curve in many measures of indicators of open government and government transparency. There are real civil liberties problems alive and well here in Vermont, and you know, this is why the ACLU is in business, and this is what we work to address. But I think it would be a mistake for anyone to be complacent or to assume that what happens elsewhere is not happening in some form or another right here in their own community.
You mentioned racial bias, open government, government transparency, all, you know, big issues. What concrete steps do you think in any of those areas would be helpful to improving the situation?
Well, you know, so this goes to a lot of the work that the ACLU Vermont is doing currently and has been doing for some years. I think, obviously, we're a multi-issue organization. We work on anything that falls under the general rubric of constitutional rights, the Bill of Rights. But if you look at our docket and the policy work that we've done, the public education work we've done, a lot of the emphasis has been, I think rightfully, on criminal justice reform, which would include police accountability, would include racial justice. It is also a lot of the emphasis has been on privacy and surveillance, a lot of it, again, on open government and transparency in government. You know, those, I think, will continue to be big priorities for us going forward and need to be, especially at this time in our history, especially with the national dialogue that we are finally having with regards to criminal justice reform. And there are a number of initiatives already underway in which the ACLU is participating and many others in the community, grassroots organizations, policymakers, and other individuals are participating in, from use of force guidelines to police officer decertification to data collection on police stops, and other aspects of criminal justice and police accountability. That work is going to continue and must continue because, again, Vermont is not such an outlier from the rest of the country when it comes to racial injustice, and institutional racism is alive and well right here in Vermont. And the fact is there is a lot that we can do and that people are already working to do to address that.
You mentioned at the beginning that, you know, many of the issues are the same state to state. But I wonder if the solutions are often different state to state.
Well, absolutely. They are. At the same time, I think it's important to And the ACLU is doing this. We are looking to the experience of other affiliates. I mean, the ACLU has the benefit of being a multi-issue, multidisciplinary, nationwide organization. We have affiliates in every state and Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. We can look to the experiences of other places and take into account what is working, what has worked, what really is not working, and why. And then we can look and see, you know, in what ways is Vermont truly different? What would work or might work here that has worked elsewhere, or what might not be a good fit? And that, you know, that's something that we are going to be doing increasingly. I mean, one of the really exciting things that we have coming up is we are expanding our policy program. We're in the process of advertising for a full-time policy director, which will be the first time the ACLU of Vermont has had a full-time policy director working at the State House and really statewide on ACLU policy initiatives. Now, my predecessor, Alan Gilbert, did a lot of work at the legislature, but that was in addition to all of the many other things he had to do, and he did an incredible job. But this is the first time that we're going to be able to devote a full-time staff person to working on advancing our policy agenda at the legislature and elsewhere in the state. I think that, combined with the fact that we now have, for the first time, two full-time staff attorneys, we have a growing staff, and really we're going to be looking to increasingly integrate those advocacy programs and expand our work, not just in criminal justice reform, but across all of our issue areas. And so it's a really exciting time to be coming on board.
What's enabled you to grow in that way now, whereas you haven't been able to do that in past years?
Well, I don't know about past years. I just know that I am extremely fortunate to be the beneficiary of a lot of good work of others that have come before me, including, in particular, Alan Gilbert, who, as over the past 12 years as executive director, has brought the affiliate to a place that it has already grown and is in a position to continue growing. And, you know, all new directors should be so lucky to be inheriting a really first-rate staff and board and an organization that is really on the rise. And you know, so I've looked back at the work that this affiliate has done over the past almost five decades. The ACLU of Vermont will celebrate its 50th anniversary next year. And looking back over that history, it wasn't all that long ago that things were very different. It wasn't all that long ago that pregnant women could be fired or not hired in the first place for being pregnant, that LGBT individuals were denied housing on the basis of their sexual orientation. It wasn't all that long ago that teachers were being forced to take loyalty oaths, or that voters were facing extremely restrictive residency requirements. So, you know, on all of those issues, the ACLU has been front and center. And to think of all of those victories right on up to our work on marriage equality, to even the last legislature, where some really good legislation on privacy, on due process rights for juveniles and others. It's incredible to see what the organization has already done, and to think that we are still, in a lot of ways, just coming into our own and still growing into a fully staffed, fully operational organization. And it's just, you know, as daunting as it is to look at you know, the challenges that lie ahead, to look back over that history, again, almost 50 years now, it's really inspiring to think that in a lot of ways our best work is still ahead of us.
So does the financial wherewithal to embark on that growth come from Vermont support, or does it come from national support through the organization?
So the ACLU receives support from the national ACLUs based in New York, but also a lot of support from supporters and donors here in the state of Vermont. We rely on the community to support our work. We're not grant funded by and large. We do receive some small grants, but largely we rely on our members and our supporters who believe that the Bill of Rights applies to all people, and that the protections of the Constitution should apply to the maximum extent to all people. And a lot of people in that state, in this state, believe that. And I think there's no organization that is better to support if you believe that, in terms of, again, looking back over the history, over the policy initiatives, the lawsuits that we filed, and the reforms that have been won and are still being won today. There's really no organization like it in terms of advancing a civil rights agenda.
Looking back on the months since you became executive director, is there anything that has surprised you pleasantly or unpleasantly?
Well, again, I'm just really blown away by the staff, the board, the community of supporters that we have. Everybody that I've spoken to has been extraordinarily supportive and enthusiastic and really believe in the work that's being done. They really believe that the organization has a role in informing policymakers, in helping policymakers, in working in the courts to defend individuals' rights, to supporting communities in their efforts to move Vermont forward towards a more inclusive, equitable, just place. And so I've just been really surprised by how, I'm from going to school here and visiting over the years, I've long been aware that Vermont has a very strong tradition of self-governance and direct democracy, from town hall meetings to the citizen legislature. And people are very informed and engaged on the issues that affect them and their communities. So I was aware of that. But being reminded of that time again, every time I go out the door, every time I talk to somebody, has been really inspiring.
That's James Duff Lyle, the executive director for the ACLU of Vermont, who took the position this summer. You can go to vpr.net and see VPR's reporting on some of the issues we covered in our interview with him today. Tomorrow, we'll have a look at a new report on hunger in Vermont. The USDA says the rate of food insecurity is improving, but anti-hunger advocates say there's still work to be done. That's our program. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Steve Zind. Thanks for listening.